From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, James Franco talks about directing and starring in the new film The Disaster Artist, about the making of The Room, which is considered one of the best worst films ever made.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
That clip that you just played, he's quoting James Dean's film Rebel Without a Cause, and he's quoting the most famous line from that film, "You're tearing me apart." And he put his own spin on it. You're tearing me apart, Lisa.
Also, Guillermo del Toro talks about directing The Shape of Water, a love story between a mute woman and an amphibious god, voiced in part by del Toro.
I did mostly the breathing of the creature and some of the clicking. When he's dying, you know, all the suffocation. That's me.
And linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us his word of the year. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Franco, directed and stars in the new movie The Disaster Artist. That's about the making of the 2003 film The Room. The Room is a movie that's been called the Citizen Kane of bad movies. The Disaster Artist is based in part on a book of the same name about the making of The Room. The co-author, Tom Bissell, describes The Room as a movie made by an alien who has never seen a movie but has had movies thoroughly explained to him. The Room has developed a cult following through midnight screenings around the country. People laugh at how ineptly made it is and how strange the leading man's performance is. That actor, Tommy Wiseau, also wrote, directed, produced, and financed The Room. James Franco plays Wiseau and befriended him during the making of The Disaster Artist. But Wiseau remains a mystery man with an unplaceable accent, which he says is from New Orleans, but is clearly not. Let's start with a scene from the 2003 film The Room. Tommy Wiseau plays Johnny, whose girlfriend Lisa has been cheating on him with his best friend. In this scene, Johnny is upset and deeply wounded because Lisa has accused him of hitting her. He's walking through the door to the roof of his building where he meets his friend Mark.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny, what's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She said that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask. What's new with you?
Well, I'm just sitting up here thinking, you know. I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You think girls like to cheat like guys do?
What makes you say that?
I don't know. I'm just thinking.
I don't have to worry about that because Lisa's loyal to me.
Yeah, man, you never know. People are very strange these days.
Now that you've heard that scene from The Room, listen to this scene from The Disaster Artist about shooting that scene. Seth Rogen plays the script supervisor who's directing the scene and has to keep giving Tommy Wiseau his lines because Wiseau can't remember them.
Action! What line? What is line?
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull****. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Okay.
Action!
What is line?
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull****. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark. Scene 112, take 13. Mark it. Action.
I did not hit her. Okay. Line.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bull****. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Take 17, action.
I hit her.
No. Do you want to change the line?
Script is script. Script says same.
You're doing great, man. We'll get there.
Action. 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 Action.
You have to say out loud. I can't hear in here. Say action so I can hear.
Okay.
So that was a scene from The Room and a scene from the new film, The Disaster Artist. James Franco, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, Terry.
So I know
this is my third time.
It is.
I don't know if you remember. This is my third
but
time.
But who's counting? Oh, I'm so glad you remember. So I think a lot of our listeners know The Room, but a lot of our listeners don't. So I'm going to ask you to describe The Room for people who haven't seen it. Like, what's your short version
sure.
of the description?
Okay, well, first I'll just say my movie, The Disaster Artist, is about the making of The Room, which is an actual movie. It is not the Brie Larson Oscar-winning movie Room. It's something else
right.
that was written and directed by and stars this man named Tommy Wiseau, who also financed it at the tune of $6 million. Now, it does not look like it was made for $6 million. It looks like it was made for about $60. It came out in 2003, and the kind of magic behind The Room is due to Tommy Wiseau. There are three mysteries to Tommy. Where he's from, because he sound like this, you know, which would suggest like Eastern Europe by way of France and trying, I don't know, maybe dialect coaches and failing at that. But he say he from New Orleans. He all-American guy. The second mystery is his age. He was at least in his late 40s when he made The Room, but claimed that he was in his 20s. And then where he got the money, the $6 million, which is the darkest mystery. I mean, the other two, you just sort of see through the thin facade. But the money, he claims that he made it, you know, selling denim at his own little shop. And every time I've questioned him about that, he, you know, adamantly insists that he made it through selling Levi's jeans. And I'm like, Tommy, come on. You don't know how many jeans that is? He's like, James, you embarrass yourself. You don't know anything about retail. And I'm like, okay. I don't. All right, fine. So anyway, real quick, the plot of The Room is this guy who, oh, by the way, if you can look him up online, but he looks sort of like the mix between like a vampire and a pirate and Michael Jackson or something like that. And and he has like long black hair that looks like it's dyed with magic marker. And
has never been washed.
Yes. And so he casts himself as Johnny, this, you know, the great guy, all-American guy. And basically the plot of the movie is his girlfriend and his best friend have an affair and betray him. And spoiler alert, he commits suicide at the end. And that's kind of it. But that says nothing about all the bizarre, you know, creative decisions, the weird side plots about drug dealers that have that never show up again, mothers-in-law who say they have breast cancer and then never mention it again, you know, just bizarreness. And almost as if some people have described this movie as the best worst movie ever made or the Citizen Kane of bad movies.
So to make your movie about the making of The Room, you had to basically study everything that makes The Room weird and unintentionally funny. The writing,
way,
the acting, the edits, the use of music, because you had to reproduce some of it in addition to telling the behind-the-scenes
yes.
story. So,
yes, but here's the thing.
Yes.
But if all we had was The Room, and we were just sort of like, let's make a movie on that, we would at best probably be able to make a spoof. In fact, what we had was this book, The Disaster Artist, that was written by Greg Sestero, who was the other actor in The Room and Tommy Wiseau's best friend, and also written by this great journalist, Tom Bissell.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's actually how I came to this whole project. I read the book right when it came out about 4 years ago. I saw it on the New York Times Book Review, and it's a Hollywood story, but it's unusual and unlike any other. And I love Hollywood stories. And so it's like before I was halfway done, I was like, oh, this is for me. So that's all to say, we had more than just The Room.
Well, you had even more than that. You had tapes You had tapes that Tommy Wiseau made of like his audio journals. Tell us about those tapes.
Okay, well, so Tommy knows I have them. Okay, so let's just say that up front.
Like, did he give them to you, or did
no? Tommy did not. Tommy did not give them to me.
How did you get them?
Greg gave them to me. So Tommy calls them now the secret tape. I know you have secret tape. So
can I just stop right there for people just tuning in? James Franco keeps lapsing in and out of Tommy's accent. So if he occasionally sounds odd to you, that is why. He's going in and out.
Not only am I lapsing into the accent, I almost can't help it. It's sort of like a virus. It's just in me now. But so it'll come out every once in a while. So 5 or 6 years before he made his magnum opus, The Room, he was in L.A., trying to make it as an actor, going to acting school. And so he would drive around in his car and talk to himself on a mini tape recorder. And it's amazing material. As an actor, you couldn't ask for anything more. It's as if I had the running inner monologue of the guy I was playing. And in fact, it was even more valuable in this case because Tommy Wiseau is the master rewriter of history. Because when he was making The Room, I think he was completely sincere. He was aiming for Brando and James Dean and came out with something completely different. But when he realized that people were laughing at his film, he then rewrote the whole, you know, his whole script. And claimed that
the script of his life, not the script of the movie.
Yes, yes, yes. Meaning he came out and said, "Oh, I intended it to be comedy," whereas in fact he had kept it in theaters on his own dime for 2 weeks to qualify for the Oscars. So he had been aiming for this great dramatic movie. He had said, you know, before, yeah, people will see my movie and they will not be able to sleep for 2 weeks. They'd be so disturbed. But then people laughed at it, and so he then said, yeah, I intended to be comedy. And now what he says about The Room is, you know, The Room is a safe place. You can laugh, you can cry, do whatever you like, express yourself, just don't hurt yourself. So I couldn't very well go to Tommy now and say, what were you like when you were making The Room? Because he wouldn't give me anything real. You know, he'd just be like, yeah, I intended to be comedy, da, da, da. So these tapes became even more valuable. They were sort of the truth. Mm-hmm. And it was a time capsule of the man from the time that he was making The Room. Even though the Room resulted in, you know, it was such a kind of wacky, bad, you know, conventionally bad thing, we're showing that the passion behind it is no different than the passion of, you know, of Francis Ford Coppola or of James Dean or me, James Franco. Like, everybody has the same level of passion. It's just that, I guess, Tommy had zero self-awareness, you know, when he was making it.
My guest is James Franco. He directed and stars in the new movie, The Disaster Artist. We'll talk more after a break. And linguist Jeff Nunberg will tell us his word of the year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, an online service used by more than 30 million homeowners to find home improvement professionals, from plumbers to remodelers, matching each homeowner with pre-screened professionals in their area. More at homeadvisor.com. And from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Franco. His latest project is directing and starring in a new movie called The Disaster Artist that's about the making of the 2003 film The Room, a movie that's been called the Citizen Kane of bad movies. Okay, so I want to play another short scene from The Room. So this isn't James Franco's movie about the making of The Room. This is from The Room itself. And so we're going to hear Tommy Wiseau as Johnny finding out that his girlfriend doesn't want to be with him anymore.
You shouldn't have any secrets from me. I'm your future husband.
You sure about that? Maybe I'll change my mind.
Don't talk like that.
What do you mean?
What do you think? Women change their minds all the time.
You must be kidding, aren't you?
Look, I don't want to talk about it. I'm going to go upstairs and wash up and go to bed.
How dare you talk to me like that? You should tell me everything.
I can't talk right now.
Why, Lisa? Please talk to me, please. You're part of my life. You are everything. I could not go on without you, Lisa.
You're scaring me.
You are lying. I never hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa.
Why are you so hysterical?
Do you understand life? Do you?
I don't know. It's, you know, you can tell somebody's like, that Wiseau's trying somehow to just channel some kind of emotion, but it's all just so out of sync. He doesn't seem to really understand human emotion either as a person, judging from how you portray his story, or as an actor. Tommy just seems like delusional. Do you think he has like a psychological or cognitive disorder? Is that a weird question? Is that okay to ask that?
That's okay to ask me. It's sort of like gets a little tricky because if I thought he was sort of like suffering, you know what I mean? If I thought like, oh man, he needs to be locked away and because he needs serious help, that's something I take very seriously. And I don't think that. I think, you know, he's living his life. He's got a community. He's not hurting anyone and he's not hurting himself. I think, you know, I think he's fine. But yeah, I think he's got a disorder that's sort of on the spectrum that maybe a lot of actors have, that I have to a certain extent, of like thinking, if I make it into the movies, I will be saved. I will be happy. And I think in Tommy's case, because I do think he was a very lonely guy, that one of the things he was seeking with this movie and also making it with his best friend Greg was friendship, a community, love. And I think in a weird way, he got that. When he shows up at these screenings, he does have a community. People are chanting his name. I know what you're going to say, like, yeah, but it's not genuine or whatever. Yeah, he has to do a certain amount of mental gymnastics to translate the laughing and the applause that he gets at those screenings into, like, just pure applause or you know, but it's still something. What happened with my movie at the first screening, the first public screening at South by Southwest, which was also the first time that Tommy ever saw the movie because he didn't want to watch it in private for whatever reason, is we showed it there. It turned out to be an incredible screening, standing ovation. I kept looking down the row at Tommy to see how he was going to react. He was wearing his shades in, you know, while watching the movie. I couldn't tell what he thought of the movie. We went up on stage to do a Q&A after, me, my brother, and Seth Rogen. We were hesitant to bring Tommy up because we didn't know what he was going to think. He famously said of the book that our movie's based on, the book only 40% true. And we're like, well, he could very well not like our movie because we based the movie on the book, and we don't want to have an awesome screening and then have Tommy come up and say, well, yeah, that movie not true, and you know, whatever. And so we didn't bring him up. And then this guy came up from the audience and asked a question. Then he said, oh, by the way, I play the real Chris R. in The Room, which is this just side character, this drug dealer named Chris R. They asked Tommy, like, why is his name Chris R.? Can't we just call him Chris? He's like, no, his name Chris R. He drug dealer, Chris R. I'm like, okay. So he's like, I played the real Chris R. Can I have a picture? And Seth Rogen's like, yeah, dude, come on up here. So Chris R. came up on stage. I look out in the audience at Tommy. He's like 15 rows back, but I can see like this darkness, this dark cloud descending on him. And I still haven't talked to him. I don't know if it's because he's jealous that Chris R. is up there or that he just hated the movie. And so I was like, Tommy, come up. Tommy, come up on stage. And he won't come up. And so then the audience in Austin all stood up and started chanting his name, Tommy, Tommy, just like in our movie. And he, you know, that's basically what he wanted. So he comes up and we still didn't give him the mic because I still didn't know what he was going to say. And it's my biggest regret. And I step off stage finally and I'm like, all right, Tommy, what'd you think? And he goes, well, yeah, I approve 99.9%. And I'm like, oh, wow. And would you, what's the 0.1%? And you think he's going to say, I never said that or whatever. And he goes, director to director, he goes, yeah, James, I think you should look at lighting in beginning of movie. And I'm like, oh, man, yeah, I'll tell my cinematographer to watch The Room for pointers. But then we realize only later that he had been wearing his shades through the whole movie. So it's like, yeah, of course the lighting's off. But here's my big point is I realized when they were cheering for him, they were cheering his story. And that, just thinking about that, it moves me right now to say that. Like, mm-hmm. He got it. He finally got what he wanted.
So I want to ask you about your movie from a few years ago, The Interview, because it seems very timely, sadly, right now. In The Interview, you played a celebrity journalist, and mm-hmm. you host a program. And as
was,
it turns
I was
out...
I was playing one of you.
That's right. So it turns out Kim Jong-un is a fan, or so he says.
Yes.
And
yes.
So he invites your character, Dave Skarlak, to interview him. And so Dave Skarlak thinks, like, this is my ticket to, like, big-time
yes.
journalism. I'm going to do it.
Yes.
And Seth Rogen is his producer. He's a little skeptical of, you know. But they go and they do it. And meanwhile, the CIA says, and while you're there, assassinate Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
Here's some ricin. You could just slip it when you shake his hand and assassinate
yes.
him with that because it's yes. it's that poisonous.
Yes.
And so what happens instead is that your character has this kind of like bromance with Kim Jong-un. They spend the day together and they play basketball and they drink margaritas and they hang out yes. with attractive women. And
They sing Katy Perry
They together. Sing a Katy Perry song and they have a great time together. So your character doesn't want to assassinate Kim Jong-un because he's so kind of smitten with him.
So silly.
But in the end, he realizes that the whole thing is a facade and Kim Jong-un is a bad
yeah.
man. And
yeah.
the assassination happens. We see his head or his whole body explode. I forget which.
Yeah, both, I think.
Meanwhile, North Korea's reaction to this, Kim Jong-un's actual reaction to the release of the movie is, do not release it or mm-hmm. there will be trouble. There were threats against theaters. There were threats to Sony.
Sony was hacked. We don't know. I guess we still don't know officially. If
we don't know if officially
North Korea or not. But
exactly.
Sony was hacked. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think we were basically told it was pretty much North
yeah.
Korea, and Sony basically released it as an on-demand, a video on-demand thing, so that people wouldn't have to feel
yeah.
like they were risking their lives to see it in a theater. Throughout that whole period, I was thinking, what is going through James Franco and Seth Rogen's minds? So I can ask you now, what was going through your mind during that period when all this really bad stuff was happening attached to the movie? It's a comedy.
It's bizarre. Yeah, it was so bizarre. And I think, you know, we'll go down in Hollywood history. And being in the middle of that was, as you can imagine, confusing. Seth and I were sort of in the dark for a while. Like, nobody was telling us what decisions they were going to make. We were sort of learning things as they came out in headlines. And then, you know, so we learned, oh, they're pulling the movie from the theaters. And I was sort of in the dark. And then I went home for the holidays. I was staying in a hotel with my grandma, and every morning we'd have breakfast together, and there's a TV in the hotel, and it would inevitably, you know, something about the interview would come up. And then one day it was like Obama came out and made a statement, and he said, you know, they should play it in the theaters. Don't be, you know, back down. We don't back down to threats like this. And he said, and it was my big moment, he said, and I love Seth Rogen. I love James Flacco. I was like, no, it's Franco, no. And I keep hoping, maybe this is the interview with Terry, the great Terry Gross, that Obama will actually hear and come out and say, okay, it's James Franco. I made a mistake.
James Franco, it's just been wonderful to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
And I love it so much. And I remember all of our interviews, and I hope we can do more.
James Franco directed and stars in the new movie, The Disaster Artist. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has chosen his word of the year. We'll let Jeff tell you what it is and why he picked it.
It's word of the year time again. Collins Dictionaries chose fake news, and Dictionary.com went with complicit. Others have proposed hashtag Me Too, alternative facts, take a knee, resistance, and snowflake. It's striking how many of those are the words and phrases that warring political camps have been hurling at each other across our deepening national divide. The Trump presidency didn't create that rift, but it sort of made it official. The acrimonious climate has ruined a lot of Thanksgivings. As two economists recently demonstrated, using cell phone tracking data, they found that Americans from politically divided families spent 20 minutes less time at the holiday dinner table after the election than the year before. Wonkish terms like hyperpolarization don't begin to convey that sense of unrelenting rancor. Instead, the meme of the moment is to say that American politics has become tribal, which I'll make my word of the year. It's not a new word even in that meaning, but in one form or another, it's become the ubiquitous diagnosis for most of our political ills. America's cursed with tribal morality. Tribalism is responsible for fake news and for our inability to confront sexual harassment. Meanwhile, people abroad raise the specter of the new tribalism wherever the traditional nation-state seems to be fraying at the seams, from Catalonia to Scotland. The word tribe is a little problematic, even in its traditional sense, as the primordial social group that predates the nation-state, united by kinship, language, and rituals. Tribe has a legal status in the U.S., and there's nothing pejorative in using it for the Chippewa or Hopi. But indigenous peoples in other parts of the world object to the word's connotations of superstition, backwardness, and savagery. Organizations like UNESCO stopped using tribe some years ago in favor of terms like nation or ethnic group. But of course, it's precisely those savage ooga-booga stereotypes that make tribes so evocative when you attach it to the political groups of modern societies. It suggests that their members have regressed to a more primitive social level, where they're motivated only by their bond with their own kind and their hostility to outsiders. At the limit, the story goes, they're driven purely by primal emotions of fear and rage, which bubble up from the evolutionary depths of what people like to call the lizard brain. With the exception of a few white supremacists, most Americans think tribalism is a bad idea, which is why the word's so often preceded by ugly or toxic. Where we disagree is in actually identifying the tribes. To a lot of people, political tribalism suggests those red and blue family members glowering at each other across the holiday dinner table, impatient to hurry back to their bubbles. They're people whose partisan identities become so central that it determines whom they're willing to date and what brands of pizza and coffee makers they buy, not to mention which news stories they're willing to believe. But for others, tribalism is just another name for identity politics. Though which identities count as tribal depends on your point of view. A Wall Street Journal editorial inveighs against what it calls the crude political tribalism of the groups on the left who are trying to divide Americans by race, ethnicity, and gender. But it gives a pass to other groups who tend to vote Republican, like white evangelicals. Yet writers on both the left and right have said that white evangelical has become more of a tribal identity than a theological one. The fact is that however people map out the geography of American political tribes, they always exempt themselves and their neighbors. In modern America, we don't think of our own political allegiances as tribal. We're the creatures of reason. That gives the word a kind of incantatory power. Calling a group tribal is just a way of pronouncing them impervious to rational discussion. Or as one political blogger put it, there's no reasoning with a reptile. There's virtually no phenomenon in public life that someone hasn't tried to discredit as tribal. A writer in National Review blames left tribalism for creating the myth of rape culture. Senator Jeff Flake says it's political tribalism for Republicans to support Roy Moore. Business consultants argue that it's the tribalism of corporate white males that keeps women and minorities out of the executive suite. But Andrew Sullivan sees feminist tribalism behind Google's efforts to hire more women engineers. The Guardian's John Abraham writes that the Republicans' tribalism has led them to deny human-caused climate change. But according to the Wall Street Journal's Holman Jenkins, it's the tribalism of progressives that leads them to refuse to debate the question. Who wouldn't find this maddening? People use tribal to obliterate the differences between solidarity and blind group loyalty, between principled concern and reflexive rage, between the cerebral cortex and the brainstem. But this isn't surprising. If we can't see eye to eye on who are the political tribes and who are the forces of civilization, it's because we're fragmented into factions that deny one another's legitimacy. That's what it means to say that America's become tribal in the first place. And one sign of that is that we can't agree on how to use the word.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California Berkeley School of Information. Coming up, we'll hear from Guillermo del Toro, who directed the new movie The Shape of Water. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Inada, creators of the Japanese-made DreamWave massage chair with shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning and nighttime sessions. Retail dealers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The Shape of Water, the new movie directed by Guillermo del Toro, is a fairy tale romance built on the foundation of classic 50s and 60s Hollywood monster movies. It takes place in 1962 and stars Sally Hawkins as Eliza, a mute woman who works cleaning a secret U.S. government facility. one laboratory also serves as the prison for a strange amphibious creature that was captured in the Amazon by government agent Richard Strickland, played by Michael Shannon. The government hopes that learning about the creature's unique biology will provide them with an advantage against the Soviets in the Cold War space race. Eliza is intrigued by the creature, befriends it, and an unconventional romance blooms. But as it becomes clear that the creature will not make it out of the lab alive, Eliza decides to help it escape. Guillermo del Toro's other movies include Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy, Hellboy 2, and The Devil's Backbone. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with a clip. Agent Strickland has called Eliza and her friend and co-worker Zelda into his office to suss out whether he can trust them to clean the lab where the secret asset, the creature, is held. Zelda, played by Octavia Spencer, explains that Eliza is mute.
I answer mostly on account of she can't talk.
She can't? She deaf?
Mute, sir. She said she can hear you.
All those scars on your neck. That's what did it, cut your voice box, right?
She said since she was a baby.
Would do that to a baby. The world is sinful. Wouldn't you say so, Delilah? Well, let me say this up front. You clean that lab, you get out. The thing we keep in there is an affront. Do you know what an affront is, Zelda?
Something offensive.
That's right. And I should know. I dragged that filthy thing out of the river muck in South America all the way here. And along the way, we didn't get to like each other much.
That's a scene from the new movie, The Shape of Water, by Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro, welcome back to Fresh Air.
I'm very happy to be here.
So why did you want to make a movie about a romance between an amphibious creature and a mute woman?
Well, the idea for me was to try and do a movie that talked about love being beyond words. And actually, the screenplay makes a point of showing you that the characters that have the power of speech, that talk, have more of a trouble communicating with each other than the characters that just are. You know, that they can discover each other and their essence through looks, through touch, through presence, body language. And mostly, you know, the urge I've had for the last more than a decade is I feel that the world is turning into a vicious, really nasty place to live because we have enthroned cynicism instead of intelligence. And every time we talk about emotions, we do so very guardedly and with the fear of appearing disingenuous. And I wanted to make a completely honest, heart-on-the-sleeve, non-ironic melodrama in which we talk about falling in love with, quote-unquote, the other, as opposed to fearing the other, which is what we face in every day in the news and politics and so forth. So these things were growing as I'm an immigrant. I feel these things acutely in one way or another. And it just so coincided that we are on the wrong side of history individually, but on the right side of history for this tale to come.
Well, speaking of history, your movie takes place in 1962 at the height of the Cold War, right during the Cuban Missile Crisis. You said before that the character played by Michael Shannon, who's the villain in your movie, if this movie was made back in 1962, he would be the hero.
Oh, 100%. And the image of the monster or the other carrying the girl on his arms would be the image of horror. And you would never go through the rear entrance of the place, through the cleaning women and the employees that you know mop and throw the garbage out. You would go through the front door with the scientists and the government agents. It would be completely different. And I think when you change that point of view, when you go through the rear entrance, when you go through the service door, you know, you take a political stance. Hmm. Also, when you view the story from these characters that exist at the margins of that type of story, you're taking another stance into giving them time, voice, and presence.
This movie is a fairy tale. Apart from the magical fish fairy tales, obviously one of the big influences on this movie is The Creature from the Black Lagoon, a movie that you said was very inspirational to you. When you were growing up, what did you respond to in that classic monster movie?
Well, when I was six, every Sunday, my family would go to church and then we would watch movies. You know, we would watch them individually on a matinee or on TV, in my case, every Sunday on Channel 6 in Guadalajara, where I lived. They dedicated most every Sunday to black and white horror films and sci-fi. So I watched Dem, I watched Tarantula, I watched The Monolith Monsters, I watched all the Universal Library. And one good Sunday after church, I was kneeling in front of the TV and I watched Creature from the Black Lagoon. And there's a beautiful, very simple, very poetic image, very fairy tale-like, of Julie Adams in a white bathing suit swimming on the surface and the creature, the Gillman, swimming underneath many, many feet below.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that scene. It's a beautiful scene.
It's a gorgeous scene, and I got overwhelmed by it in the way that you get overwhelmed by art. I was six. I couldn't articulate that it represented love for me, but it did. I saw love, the encapsulation of the yearning and all that, and having not seen the movie before, I was disingenuously thinking that they would end up together, you know, and they didn't. And, you know, the logical consequence 46 years later is that I do a Douglas Sirk, a Stanley Donen, and Vicente Minnelli influence melodrama / musical / spy thriller about them getting together.
Yeah, you got it all in there, that's for sure.
Yes.
So that's a beautiful scene that Julie Adams is swimming on top of the water and the creature's about 10 feet underneath and they're swimming parallel, but he's looking up at her. I don't think she knows that he's there.
She's unaware.
Yeah.
You know, it was a beautiful, unrequited love image, you know, quintessentially romantic, quintessentially fairy tale, quintessentially B-movie monster. You know, the multiplicity of that moment, the beauty of it, really floored me. And I started drawing the creature after that when I was a kid. I would draw the creature riding on a double bicycle with Julie Adams having an ice cream, a triple cone ice cream, you know. And I really, he's one of my favorite creatures from the Universal catalog. And they come to symbolize for me so much more. Like, this creature is not, for me, this is not an interspecies movie. It's a movie where a woman falls in love with an elemental god of the water. The creature is not a slimy monster from a B movie. It's the shape of water. It's a representation of a river, of the water as a force, and it's gorgeous. Is we jokingly used to say we're going to create the Michelangelo's David of amphibian men.
Let's talk a little bit about the creation of your creature, the design, which I know is something you're passionate about. What did you want to convey in its design?
You know, because it's a god of the river, I wanted to for it to have majesty and beauty. So I got inspired a lot by Japanese engravings, for example. There's a series of great of engravings in Japan about a fish that is called the great carp. And carps are very revered aesthetically in Japan, and the way they rendered the skin in the scales of the creature, of the fish, was beautiful. And I used that as one of the bases, and the others were salamanders, reptilian, blah, blah, blah. But to organize it so you could look at it and go, that's a beautiful creature. That is gorgeous. It's not a monster. It is the other. You know, it's not a human, but it is an absolutely exquisitely designed, a swimmer's body. You know, we sculpted the face also very, very carefully. We did X number of permutations on the lips. Because if you imagine his...
Yeah, it has nicer lips than a carp.
Yes, much nicer. You cannot... And they need to be human, and at the same time, they need to be kissable, right. You know?
Well, I don't want to get too prurient here, but, I mean, the relationship between your creature, elemental god, and Eliza, it's consummated. And
yes.
You actually have two of your characters, played by Sally Hawkins and Octavia Spencer, do a little bit of expository dialogue about fish anatomy. So, you know, were you sitting? How it works. Were you sitting around with your creature designers, discussing the mechanics of this interspecies sex? Or?
We actually did. If you watch the movie again and you pay attention to the concerned area, you would see that mechanically we designed it to work the way Sally describes. Now, the beautiful thing about this movie, and this is important to say, is that it is a movie that talks about love and talks about sexuality in a way that is very human, very encompassing, almost healing, mm-hmm. and emotionally beautiful. And we juxtapose the extraordinary and the ordinary in a way that I'm very proud of. We have an extraordinary creature, a river god, but we keep it in a bathtub. There is nothing prurient in the movie. We talk about many facets of human sexuality, alone and not alone, mm-hmm. in a way that has not a fetishistic, not a prurient, not a wink-wink, nudge-nudge type of approach to this. It's very, very, very natural, very quotidian. And we start with the protagonist alone in the bathtub, and is not seen through the fetishized, super stylized gaze of movie making, love making. It is very naturalistic. And the moment she and the creature get together is done almost like a painting. It is so poetic and balletic that, you know, you never see anything shocking except the notion.
Well, it's like a very classic movie where you fade to black.
Yeah, we literally draw a curtain.
Yeah.
But what is beautiful is then what we do is that is the extraordinary. And then the next day, we have the ordinary, where she's sharing a morning chat with her friend. And she says, how was it? and they can talk about how it was. You
know? Well, you're also taking this idea of a fairy tale to its adult and natural conclusion. Like, you know, like Beauty and the Beast,
true.
Or the Princess and the Frog.
Yeah, but what I find very contentious about those fairy tales is that they are all pivoted on perfection and transformation, mm-hmm. meaning the princess needs to be an innocent, a perfect innocent, you know? Mm-hmm. And it sort of embodies a male idea of the female role. You know, she needs to be pure and altruistic, and she doesn't seem three-dimensional to me. She doesn't seem complex. And we take care of it in the movie in many ways, including showing that she has her own sex life in a lonely way, or an alone way, but not lonely, you know. Mm-hmm. And we also give her a life that is not grand, but very fulfilling. And we don't transform the creature. We don't transform it into a boring prince at the end of the movie so that they can be together forever. He stays in its carnal form an animal, and he still has a very controversial diet of raw protein that includes cats.
That's right.
You know, and he doesn't get civilized and eat a cat with a fork and a knife. it still is what it is. Because to me, if we're going to talk about love, we're going to talk about understanding, not transformation.
I want to change the subject for a second. I want to talk mm-hmm. about Bleak House, not the Charles Dickens novel, but... You have.
We can talk about that one too.
I want to talk about this other one. You have two houses in Los Angeles, neither of them that you live in, and they house your collection. They're called Bleak House 1 and Bleak House 2. Can you please describe what you have in those houses?
Well, actually, I do live in those houses now because when I come from Toronto, I stay there.
I see.
You know, what it is, and you can access, if you Google it, or we put out a book called Cabinet of Curiosities. But what it is I am surrounded by the characters I loved as a child. There is a small Gilman altar for the creature from the Black Lagoon. There is Frankenstein is all over the place, the creature of Frankenstein. But the main purpose of it was to create a library. So I have 7,000 DVDs and Blu-rays. Mm. I have thousands of books, thousands. And roughly 15,000 comic books or something like that, hundreds of books about different art movements, the symbolists, the Dadaists, the Pre-Raphaelites, the Impressionists, you know, that I consult and before I start every movie. So I said, okay, I'm going to get my own space because I'm 40-something. I want to live in a space that I designed that is for me. And I got a house and... created my dream house with secret passages, sliding bookshelves, a room that is called the rain room, where it rains 24/7. Rain is a rarity in California. So I have a false window with a theatrical projection and surround sound of the distant thunder and rain. It's very soothing for me. That's where I write. And then eventually I had to buy the house next door.
Well, I love the fact that, you know, it seems like you filled up one house and you're like, well, better get another one. Let's get a sequel.
Yes. Well, and the two houses communicate through the backyard.
I have a
cabin in the back that is dedicated to Japanese culture. I have a gazebo that I'm going to turn into a writing office. You know, it is. I think that the only measure for me of happiness at the age of 53 is, do I live the way I want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and right now I can say yes.
So my producer, Heidi Simon, read that your camera is always in movement. You're using cranes a lot and steady cams. Is there a reason behind that?
Yes. It's not only a lot. It's constant. Meaning, the last time I used a tripod was in 2001.
Hmm.
So for 16 years, the camera is always moving. Now, sometimes it moves very little. It's jibbing, pushing, dolling laterally. But it's because I think that film has more to do with rhythm and movement and things that you cannot put in words than people give it credit for. And my camera needs to be like a musical movement. In the case of Shape of Water, I wanted it to feel like a song. Mm. I wanted people to come out of the movie humming the movie. And that the movie had that energy, that the camera was fluid like water, but also like it was a musical. Because there's a lot of the movie that is shot like an old-fashioned Hollywood musical. The camera is always meeting and roaming and in favor of the characters being met in a choreographed way, like they're almost going to break in song any minute. Pan's Labyrinth is a lullaby. This is a song. You know, and now and then I do crazy symphonies.
Guillermo del Toro, thanks so much for being on Fresh Air.
No, my pleasure, and it's always great to be here.
Guillermo del Toro directed the new film, The Shape of Water. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.